My belief is that if we are able to create AGI, it will quickly turn into super AI, super artificial intelligence, simply because, you know, AI operates exponential speeds, not so as our brains, which are very slow. A super AI can be really fast. So if we both create artificial general intelligence at the same time, but mine is like 3 seconds before you, yours is lost. That's my vision, because mine will get so much more better in those 3 seconds that it will be so much more better than yours than when you reach AGI after 3 seconds. If we just let AI run and we don't keep up, we don't understand how the AI works, and we don't build AI in the correct way, I think as a species, we have a problem. And it's of course very difficult to say, well, it's going to displace 100 million jobs, 200 million jobs, a billion jobs. It's very difficult to say something about that. It will also create a lot of jobs, but most of these jobs will be for well-educated people. There are plenty of other jobs that will be lost because of AI.
Welcome to Oz NFTs, NFTs are for Everyone podcast.
Every week, we'll bring you Australian artists, collectors, and builders that are paving the way in the Web3 space.
We'll go deep into their stories, how they're reshaping digital culture, and how you can get involved.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for joining us on the NFTs are for Everyone podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Josh and myself. I'll do a brief intro, just real quick. You are a digital speaker helping businesses, brands, people understand and embrace technology, helping them not be fearful of it, but embrace it and helping them better their lives. You cover AI, blockchain, metaverse.
Basically any digital technology. Anything that's cutting edge, anything that's going to change our world.
Big data analytics. Yeah, the whole lot.
That's how I started.
Okay.
Before we dive in, I want to hear about how you started.
Yeah,
fair enough. So I started about over a decade ago, which actually did just a slight side story before that, because I became an entrepreneur because I actually went on a big adventure. I cycled around this beautiful country, Australia. I cycled around it in 100 days for charity. So that's four times Tour de France, back to back, same time frame, same distance. For those listeners that are interested in some statistics.
Classic Dutchman coming to Australia and having to conquer the whole thing on
as
a bicycle.
As you do.
Of course.
As you do. So I did that, which was an amazing journey, an amazing adventure. And then I didn't want to work for Boss anymore. So I said, screw that. I'm not going to do that anymore. So I tried to get my own company started. And after,
how old were you at that
stage? 27. I had a great job. I had a good job, which I didn't like, but a really good job as a starting point after your career, but I just didn't like it. So I went on an adventure and I pursued my own dreams. And I've done that ever since. So I came back, tried to start my company, failed multiple times. And then I had one final shot to do so. And I thought, well, at that time, big data is going to be hot. So let's do something in big data. So I thought about it on Sunday. I had my website live on Monday. And I started publishing articles about big data because I had no clue what big data really was. And a month and a half later, I was invited as the expert to deliver a paid keynote at a conference about big data.
Wow, I think we could do a whole podcast just on this journey here. That'd be amazing. Wow.
Clearly, Australian sun had some effect on on this budding entrepreneur.
Or the women. I don't know. It must have been one of the two.
I'll leave that in the middle.
That's amazing. Okay, so you've come down. And I just want to talk a little bit about the businesses real quick. So did you find that those failures ultimately led to your success? You know, like without those failures, would you have been able to come into this most recent business that you started?
Oh, I think, of course, you know, failures they help you. And there's nothing wrong with failing, you know. I tried with different co-founders, different concepts, different ideas, and some went a bit further than the other. We even tried resurrecting a 400-year-old Dutch ship from Russia. So yeah, I did a few crazy things.
We'll definitely book it another podcast.
So I did a few crazy things, and obviously they all failed, which is it was fine. It gave me a good experience of what to do and what not to do. And along the way, you know, after I started my business, I had another co-founder that didn't work out, and I started another business later on in the area of misinformation that didn't work out either. But along the way, I continued with my big data platform, which is now called Dataflog. It's a media platform around emerging tech, kept going, and it's still there. So which is kind of cool.
Congratulations. Epic.
Thanks.
Did that set the platform for eventually what would become the digital speaker?
Yes, of course, because you know, I think in the end, the fact that I was invited as a keynote speaker after a month and a half was already crazy, and the fact that then I continued to write my articles, and after about 3 months, I thought, well, I must have a book by now. Mm-hmm. So I collected all my articles that I'd written, and I thought, well, that's just almost a book indeed. So I wrote a book proposal in 2 hours, and a month later, I had a book contract signed with a major publisher. I was like, this is pretty crazy. Wow. And that's how my first book came about. And then I thought, okay, now I have to write it. So I wrote the book. It was published in 2014 called Think Bigger. And along the way, I was doing more and more keynotes and more speaking engagements. So in the meantime, I did my PhD here at University of Technology in Sydney and wrote another book. I turned my PhD in a third book. So I was doing more and more keynotes. And then the pandemic hit. And then obviously, I couldn't speak anymore. So my these physical keynotes, so my entire calendar was cleared, and I thought, like, this is pretty crap. So I've got to do something. So then I thought about myself. I'm going to turn myself into the digital speaker. So I'm going to make myself available as an avatar, as a hologram. I actually delivered the world's first TEDx talk in virtual reality, which was pretty cool. I've been using that brand ever since. I'm currently rebranding it from a marketing perspective. I'll keep the name, it continues to grow. And I really try to, as whatever I do, because I'm in cutting edge technologies, and whatever I do, I really try to practice what I preach. So, for example, for my fifth book, I use ChatGPT to write the entire book. So, yeah, I use avatars, I use holograms, I'm building a digital twin of myself. So, I'm really trying to, and not everything works, you know. I would actually say the majority fails, but it helps me to understand how these technologies work.
Break and fix.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't wait to see our digital twins.
I was about to say, they probably look pretty similar. I see an underlying trend here is content. You've just been a mass publisher of content, well thought out, well researched content, but your premise has been, I want to ingest information, synthesize it, and put it back out. Is that the future? We're seeing the creator economy, data, big data is becoming the new oil. How important do you see content and people's personal content becoming in the future?
That's a really good question. Yeah, I think so. Because it's, you know, with all these AI tools, and there are some amazing AI tools out there, being creative becomes so much easier. Yeah, I just coined the term, I think, therefore I create, which I thought was quite funny. because I think that's what it is. You know, now that you can think, you can create. Yesterday I was with my daughter on Midjourney, and I asked her, you know, imagine something. And she said, I want a rainbow and a unicorn. So I typed in, imagine rainbow unicorn, and boom, a rainbow unicorn. And she was like, wow, this is crazy. And then I upscaled it and I printed it, and it's now above her bed. And she saw it this morning, and she was like, totally happy, you know? I couldn't have done that like a couple of months ago. And I think from that perspective, you know, having, you know, these tools available to you to be creative, I think that's really powerful. If you're going to start to rely on them solely to produce content, I don't think that's a good idea. I think we still have our own creativity, our own use. For example, my book, Future Visions, written by ChatGPT. It was written by ChatGPT, but I was the one who asked the questions. I gave the prompt. It was a collaboration. So I asked, I gave the prompt, it gave an answer that gave me, allowed me to ask a second prompt, etc. And I had used about 150 prompts to sort of write the book. I think from that perspective, these technologies are super powerful. Because, you know, also in architecture, you can use it in architecture to, you're an architect and you're stuck with ideas, or you want to get some creativity flowing, you can use these tools. We should see it from that perspective. If we're going to flood the internet with low quality AI driven content, I think we are on the wrong path.
So it's about not fearing the technology itself, but understanding how to use it to its fullest ability.
Yeah, so these technologies are neutral. So we can use it for good things, we can use it for bad things. You know, a hammer is neutral. I can use it to kill someone, and I can use it to build a house. And this is the same thing. They are very advanced technology, although, yeah, you could ask the question how advanced they really are, but that's a different question. But they are yeah, tools, and we should see them as tools. You know, they are a means to an end. They're not the end. You know, they're not the end goal.
You mentioned creativity and the fact that, you know, we are still, as humans, the ones that are using the tool and employing our own creativity upon them. Do you see AI or AGI? And if you could actually describe the difference between the two of those, that would be great. Do you see it developing its own creativity to the point where it doesn't require humans' input?
That's very well possible, that AI becomes powerful enough to be creative. Currently, it's not. It's just doing pattern recognition, statistical analysis, you know, given context, given the context of letter A, and this context, likely that letter B will follow, and then letter C will follow. So that's that. You can hardly call that creativity. So it's you know, pure creativity requires something more. Maybe it requires consciousness. What is consciousness? We humans have no clue. Maybe AI is already conscious. If it were, we wouldn't be able to see it because we don't know what consciousness is in our own lives. And so from that perspective, I think there's a long way to go. So we are currently in a phase where we have artificial narrow intelligence or narrow AI, where, you know, AI is very, very good at a very, very specific domain. Just like a calculator is very good at calculations. You know, Siri can do all kinds of cool stuff for you, but you shouldn't ask her to drive your car. Not yet. But maybe in the future with Apple cars coming out. Or was that project stopped? I can't remember. But it's you know, from that perspective, you know, and it's still very, very narrow domain, and it can't transition from one domain to another domain. Now, there's a lot of work, you know, fundamental research being done in that area to, you know, create AI that can use what they learned in one domain and transfer it to another one. It's called transfer learning. There's a lot of progress being made, especially in like games and Atari games, you know, but that's still very, very early days. So AGI, artificial general intelligence, is where you have AI that is as capable or as intelligent as one human being. And as such, it can, you know, succeed and be very powerful in different fields and different areas, regardless of, you know, encountering it. For example, if you see a young child and sees an ambulance, after seeing one ambulance, he or she will know what an ambulance is. Yeah, ask it to a computer, and it needs millions of images to determine if that car is an ambulance, yes or no. There's a massive difference between human intelligence and artificial intelligence.
So we're not actually there yet.
No, I don't think so. It's difficult to make a prediction when it will be, because I think that depends on a lot of stuff, and there's a lot of stuff happening in behind the scenes that we don't know. Yeah, nobody saw really ChatGPT coming, but they've been obviously working on it for a very long time. So I think the same applies to artificial general intelligence. I am convinced it will happen at some point. And when that will happen, that will completely change everything. I'm convinced it will change what it means to be human. Because, you know, my belief is that if we are able to create AGI, it will quickly turn into super AI, so super artificial intelligence. Simply because, you know, AI operates, you know, at the exponential speeds, not so as our brains, which are very slow. Super AI can be really fast. So if we both create artificial general intelligence at the same time, but mine is like 3 seconds before you, yours is lost. That's my vision, because mine will get so much more better in those 3 seconds that it will be so much more better than yours and when you reach AGI after 3 seconds. So that's sort of Nick Bostrom, a professor from Oxford University, has written a famous book about that, Superintelligence, which is absolutely recommendable for anyone who is interested in this domain. Says also that there can only be one super AI, because, you know, the moment you create super AI, it will make sure that the rest can't reach that, unless we build it correctly, but that's a different story then.
So you sound, what you've just described sounds like it's an inevitability, not a possibility.
I think so. I think it's sort of the next step in evolution. That sort of, if evolution creates intelligent beings, as it did with humans, then I think the next logical step is just artificial intelligence.
Okay. So I saw this post, World Economic Forum, everyone's favorite Empire Strikes Back group. They mentioned that about 85 million jobs will be displaced by artificial narrow intelligence, but in closing those opportunities, another 97 million will open. Now, I don't know the source and where, what kind of authority that they're coming from on that, but if that's just in the application of narrow AI, I'm not asking for a prediction here, but does this super intelligence change that again completely? Like, will we have effectively, our workforce become irrelevant?
Look, if you look at super AI, and again, this is hypothetical, far away in the future.
Down the rabbit Skynet. Nah, not quite Skynet, but...
I hope not.
I'm thinking like the Jetsons.
Yeah, yeah. Right? But look, so super AI to humans is like humans to ants. So to an ant cannot fathom how we humans, how it, what we are, can create what we can create. Yeah, to an ant, a skyscraper is just part of nature, if it can even fathom, because it's so high and so small. Same thing will apply to when we create super AI. It will come up with things and solutions and challenges and problems with those challenges that we can't even fathom. Okay. You know, that we can't grasp it, because it's just way beyond our intelligence. And that's why Elon Musk says we need to, integrate with AI in order to stand a chance. And to some degree, I do agree with that, because, you know, AI beats humans, but humans collaborating with AI will beat AI. How that will displace any jobs in the future remains to be seen. But I think if we just let AI run and we don't keep up, we don't understand how the AI works, and we don't build AI in the correct way, I think as a UN, as a species, we have a problem. And it's of course very difficult to say, well, it's going to displace 100 million jobs, 200 million jobs, a billion jobs. It's very difficult to say something about that. It will also create a lot of jobs, but most of these jobs will be for well-educated people. So the truck driver will lose its job, for sure. There are plenty of other jobs that will be lost because of AI. So there will be a challenge in society how to go about that.
And you mentioned collaborating with the AI. Are you referring to like building alongside with it and making sure we understand and setting parameters for it as we go?
Yeah. So we neural networks are so complicated that many researchers just don't understand them, because they have so many layers that how an AI came to a certain decision is very, very difficult to understand. Now, imagine...
Wait, is that current AI?
That's current AI.
So we don't actually understand how they came to a decision? No. Okay. But I thought you said it was like statistics and probability.
Well, that's the language model.
Yeah.
So a neural network, has many, many different layers to it.
Yeah.
And the output of one layer is the input for another layer.
So we don't actually understand how it came to that.
There's plenty of research where you see that, for example, a couple of years, I think in 2018, Facebook created an AI. Three bots had to interact with each other, and two bots had to... I'm not sure if I say it correctly, but the gist is around that the two bots had to keep something secret for a third bot, and they created a new encryption method or new language that the researcher didn't understand, so they pulled the plug. That's 5 years ago. So from that perspective, we need to build AI that we can understand, and that's very, really, really difficult. And you should also remember that, the technology that we build today will be here for the next 50 years. You only have to go to the world's financial services, the world's banks, and look under the hood, and you see cobalt. They run on cobalt, pull the cobalt, and the whole banking system will collapse. The AI that we create today will remain in place as a fundamental building block of the AI, of maybe a very tiny one, of the AI 50 years from now. But it will have an effect. So today, already, we should think about this. How are we going to create AI? What kind of morals do we instill? What kind of ethics do we instill? Which ethics? You go to an entire philosophical rabbit hole here if you go that down that route. But these are things that are very, very important to think about.
I've never gone that deep that quickly. My brain is spinning. Do you mind if I just pivot for a moment? Because whilst this is super exciting and we can't really say where this is going, it's also opening up a massive opportunity for entrepreneurs. And I don't think it's been a more accessible time, yet simultaneously competitive time for people to work out how they can create value in this new emerging economy. And on that, you've mentioned previously that this tech, and including like going back to like metaverse and blockchain, it's opening up a $1 trillion social economy. Now, hearing that, I'm like, wow, that's $1 trillion of whole new value. Like, could you explore a bit of that? Like, where that idea came from, and will this be a distributed economy, or will we be like looking at a centralized thing like Facebook?
Those are some big questions. And $1 trillion social economy comes from my book, Step Into the Metaverse, where I explored what the metaverse is going to be and what the metaverse is, because nobody really understands what the metaverse is. The metaverse, first and foremost, is not Web3, is not virtual reality, is not gaming. Get some myths out of the way.
Can we do this? Yeah,
it can be all of these above, though, by the way. Yeah, but it's not by definition in itself. The metaverse is simply the next iteration of the internet. Yeah, we had the people call the Web 1. You know, the start of the web, internet, where you know it's just sort of a read only almost. Then we had the social web where we could engage, and we had the mobile web where we can use it. You know, yeah, there's an app for that, and now we're moving to the immersive internet, yeah, where we move from a 2D internet to a 3D internet. Or more so, where we move from making a conscious decision to go on the internet with your phone or your smartwatch or your laptop or whatsoever, to being immersed in the internet. That's the difference. So we're moving from going on the internet to being in the internet, and the internet being surrounded and being as pervasive as the air we breathe. So that's where we're heading. In that world, where the internet is everywhere, the digital world is everywhere, we create 100 or 1,000 times more data than we do today. Now, if you know that big tech already, you know, uses and collects and stores and abuses our data today and is almost all powerful, then imagine only what happens tomorrow if we build the next iteration of the internet in the same centralized fashion as we did with the current internet. So my book was really focused on how to create an open metaverse, how to create a metaverse where, you know, it's owned and controlled by us, and not just big tech. We have full control over our own data. We have full control over our own digital assets. We have full control over our own identity. And while I, of course, you know, very much hope that we end up in an open metaverse, the chances of us actually ending up in an open metaverse, realistically speaking, are not very big, because big tech is already all powerful, and they see also that this $1 trillion opportunity, and they will do everything in their power to keep their power, unless we as a society say stop, we don't want that. You know, we want to get our control back. If we dare to stand up against big tech, which is very difficult because big tech lobbies and funds everything and does fund all the research and, you know, etc. They have a strong position and an incentive to keep the status quo. But I think if we look from a societal perspective and instead of focusing on a tiny elites being ultra, 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 ultra rich, maybe we should be a bit more egalitarian and create a society where everyone stands to benefit from, and instead of just a tiny, tiny elite. That's not a socialist or a communist perspective. That's just, I think, a common sense perspective, you know, where we just need to have a different approach to what we're building, because the technology that we're building is going to be so powerful. That if we don't build that correctly, if we don't govern that correctly, I think we are in for really big troubles in the decades ahead.
And how do we do that? How do we build it and govern it properly, like you're saying?
I think that there are three ways I think that we can do that. because the way we move at the moment, you know, there are tons of problems. We have polarization. We have, you know, misinformation. We have deep fakes. We have harassment. We have abuse. We have trolls. We have scammers, hackers. The list is ongoing. In the immersive internet, that list will only go much bigger. Yeah. Just to give you one.
Sorry, just to quickly dive in. Web 3 and the immersive internet, or Web 3 and the metaverse, are they interchangeable based on your definition?
Web 3 is infrastructure, in my definition. Web 3 is required for an open metaverse. Web 3 is not required for the metaverse. There's only one metaverse, by the way, just like there's only one internet. But we can build the metaverse on centralized technology, like we've built the current web. That means a closed internet, a closed metaverse, which is owned and controlled by big tech. Or we build it on Web 3 technology. Which means decentralized storage, decentralized bandwidth, decentralized etc., NFTs, all those things, and then we control our own data.
And that's the open metaverse.
That's the open metaverse, which obviously I hope we will end up in, which the chances of us ending up in that direction are very small.
But to get there, it's helping people adopt decentralized technologies, start engaging in their, say, digital identity online through a wallet.
So in order to not end up in a dystopian digital future, I think we need three things. We need education, we need verification, and we need regulation. Education, first and foremost, to understand what this is all about. You know, 99.99% of the people have no clue. And again, I don't blame anyone, because the technology is moving so fast. It's my job to stay up to date, and even for me, it's difficult. So let alone if you're a parent with three children, how on earth are you going to find the time to do so? Or you are a CEO of a big company, you have much bigger fish on your plate that you need to sort out. Education is crucial for all levels in society. And that's why I'm building a research institute to achieve that. Because we need to educate government, because they need to make the regulation, which we'll come to in a second. But governments around the world have no clue, absolutely zero. They have no clue what's happening, and they have no clue what kind of regulation. If they make regulations, often too late, and it's often influenced by big tech. There are some examples, some exceptions in the world. The European Union is doing quite well with GDPR, with the AI Act and the Digital Media Act. But in general, it's slow and too late. Enterprise government, they need to know what's happening here. They need to know how to use these technologies so they can benefit from it. But then if they want to use these technologies, they should also know how to deal with it. I only have to call out Optus or Medibank to know how far away we are from an optimal scenario, how to go about these technologies. Then we have the startups and scale-ups who are building the technology. They often build this technology with the greatest intention, but they forget to think about the unintended consequences. And when the moment the big tech comes by with a big paycheck, they are easy to sell out, because how difficult it is to say no to a big paycheck. But from a societal perspective, I don't think that's the right approach, because big tech, the bigger fish only gets bigger if they continue to eat the small fish. And then the final one is, we need to educate our general public, and we need to educate our children. The general public being anyone, millennials and the children being Generation Z and Generation Alpha. They might be digitally natives, but they're not digitally literate. They don't understand how to behave in the digital world. As a consequence, we have many, many more problems in the coming years than we have already today. So first and foremost, we need to educate people what this is all about. I can't blame anyone, because we have sort of sleepwalked into this digital age.
We're up to education and bringing people up to speed, including governments and everyday people, with what's actually happening, because we're sleepwalking into a digital renaissance. Okay. There's a lot to cover there. It's a lot of ground. And you mentioned misinformation as well. So it's like you're fighting two battles.
I think we're fighting many battles. Misinformation being only one of them, which is a very annoying one, but only being one of them. Misinformation is a very difficult problem to tackle, not only because I've tried it for 2 years in that field, but just because it's, you know, there are powerful players at play here who benefit from misinformation. So it's very difficult to do something about that. However, I think, again, education will help. If we require this kind of, you know, digital literacy to become part of our educational system from very early on, I think that is you know, very, very important, and also I think we should also see it from us as humans. You know, one thing that I absolutely hate seeing is I have 2 young children myself, and is that other people have their young children putting the phones in front of the kids at dinner or even in the pram, you know, so that the kid can't even look somewhere else, even if he or she wants to, and we sort of stuff this phone into their face from like 1 year old or even younger, that really, you know, hurts me. I can't believe why you would do that to your own children.
It's like a $500 babysitter that's available anywhere at any time.
Yeah, no, but why did you get children then?
I 100% agree with you, man.
Children's are hard work.
I remember working in a cafe 13 years ago.
Yeah,
and still seeing that. And, you know, the kids sitting there, and I just, it was blowing, just blew my mind then.
Yeah.
So I can imagine now, especially with an immersive internet coming in.
I find that, yeah, every time I see it, it sort of breaks my heart, you know, for a kid, you know, because the kid didn't ask for it. And it can't just watch anywhere else than in this phone with flashy things and sounds and everything. And I can't imagine what it does to them.
It's a poker machine for dopamine. Oh.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, and the same thing applies to, for example, social media. Social media is dopamine, but social media also sedates us. It makes us less conscious. It makes us less aware of what's happening in the world, of who we are as a person, who we are as a species. And, you know, we all mindlessly doom scroll on our phone. And in the meantime, we don't see what's happening in the real world. I think that sort of happened to us. And I think now we need to stop that because we can only stop that by making people aware of it. Hence, you know, the mission of my new research institute is to make people to elevate the world's digital awareness, because I honestly think we need to.
I want to dive into that. Can you tell us a little bit more about your research institute?
Sure. So the institute is really focused on ensuring a thriving digital future, and doing that so through in-depth research, independent research, very important.
Very, very important. Yeah.
Which will be delivered through immersive, personalized storytelling. Really in a way that is beneficial to humans in a way that they can, understand what's happening, and they can understand these new technologies in ways that suit everyone. So that's the idea.
So you've taken something like storytelling, which is obviously so fundamental for how humans learn and retain information. Can you explain a little bit about how you're using that practically?
Well, it's still very early days of the research institute, but the idea is that, you know, just like I do in my keynotes and in my online content that I create, the best thing is to tell stories and to understand what's happening in this space, which moves at breakneck speed, and then take that apart, understand it, and share that in a story-wise way so people can relate to it and can understand it. I think if we do that, then we can, you know, form part of the education, which I think is so important of the triangle of education, verification, and regulation. So with the institute, I want to focus on the education part. So it's an ed tech business. We're very early days. We're currently raising funds to make that happen. But I think it's absolutely crucial because if we don't educate ourselves, you know, it's the same thing if you go to China. And if you don't speak Mandarin, you might have a good time, but it will be difficult to move around. Yeah? You know, if you don't speak the language, you can't talk to people, you can't ask any questions, you don't really understand what's going on. And the same thing applies to the digital world. Yeah? If you speak Mandarin and you go to China, you have a much better experience. Same applies to the digital world. If we speak the language of the digital world, if you understand the digital technologies, you can move around much better, and we can prepare our society much better for what's happening and for what's ahead than if we don't.
A lot of people could say they're educators, but is this where you start to tie in verification to education? So it's like this is a verified information source. Like a blue check mark.
Yeah, yeah. Which you then shouldn't be able to buy for $8, but that's a different story.
But who regulates that in an open and decentralized metaverse?
Yeah, very good, very good point. So verification is my second point, because verification is, and if you talk about misinformation and deep fakes, you know, creating a deep fake is super easy nowadays. I'm building a digital twin myself, so if I can do it, you can do it of me as well. And you can be me, you can sound me like me, you can look like me, talk like me, and then people will think that you are me because we are gullible, we're easy to fool. So if we can't verify that that person is you or me, I think we have a problem. So verification, from that perspective, which can be done by NFTs, for example, soulbound tokens, in combination with biometrics. There's still some challenges there, but you know, that's just some kind of reason approach we can do, unless you, of course, your wallet gets hacked, you know, your computer, you know. But apart from that, there's some verification possible. The same thing applies also from an AI modeling. And if you build AI, I think we should create accountants for AI that will verify, analyze, and certify the AI as being independent, unbiased, explainable, and easy, and that we understand what's going on, so that we can verify that these AI are doing what they say they do. But also from a blockchain perspective, from a data perspective, then we can verify that this data is untampered with and is stored on the blockchain in the correct format, is high quality data, and we can trust. Because trust is crucial here. So we need to be able to verify the tools that we build, the data that we use, the people we interact with, all those kind of things. If we can't do that, if we can't verify, I think we have a big problem. Because as we saw with Twitter, when they made the blue check mark available for anyone for $8, quickly people started to impersonate a lot of people and companies, resulting in a $15 billion market devaluation of a company called Insulin, which on this case I thought was really good because Insulin should be sort of free. But that's a different story.
Kind of a weird karmic turnaround, right?
Yeah. I thought actually that was really funny and actually well-deserved but that's a different story. But it's verification is really important.
What about verification for identifying whether a piece of content has been created by AI?
Well, that's also linked to that. You know, we see already that watermarks are being created. There's a book called AI 2041 I forgot the name, Kai-Fu Lu or Lee, I think, or Lee. But anyway, interesting book about AI in 20 years from now. We're now 18 years, they talk about deep fakes and you know, watermarks, and you get this AI fight where you know the good guys creating watermarks and tools to recognize deep fakes, and then you know it becomes more and more difficult, more and more expensive. But if you have plenty and unlimited funds, which governments and large companies do have, you can always win because it's always easier to attack than to defend. That perspective, you know, we need these verifications to. It won't stop at all, but at least to get rid of the vast majority to make sure that we can trust what we see. Because nowadays, at the moment, you can't trust anymore what you see. You know, if I don't see it with my own presence here in this room, anything can be said or done online. You know, and we saw that happening a couple of years ago with Trump. Who immediately said, "Oh, that's a deep fake that I what I said about women." And, you know, we immediately see that people are going to use this, we should really think about that. We can verify what is happening. So that's really important.
And then we did get sidetracked, but it brings us to our third part of the triangle, which is regulation.
Yeah, so if we are able to verify what we're dealing with, and if we are educated, we're also better in place to regulate it. Because if we let capitalism thrive, we'll get problems that we have to have today, you know, where big tech becomes all powerful and it doesn't operate necessarily in the interest of our society, but it operates in the interest for the shareholders. And I think we should move from a shareholder perspective to a stakeholder perspective and from a short-term to a long-term perspective. Regulation is therefore very important so that we can govern all this technology in the right direction. And I think history has sort of shown that the industry is not very capable of self-regulating. So we need governments for that. That doesn't mean that governments should stifle innovation. No, on the contrary, we should build regulation that still enables this innovation. It allows for failures, because we need to and if you innovate, you fail as well. You need to be able to allow for that. But then we need to be able to use that regulation to guide, to give people also confidence, and that they can trust something, or that they and I think regulation is very, very important. If we, we're currently living in the Wild West, and we all know how the Wild West was 200 years ago. So let's not recreate that.
So if you're building a business today with full knowledge of where technology is going, how important verification, regulation, and education are going to be in the future, but you're an entrepreneur and you really wanted to start, what would be the kind of the first steps? What would be the first things you'd be looking at? If you were in logistics, hospitality, entertainment, media, content creation, even if you were going so far as maybe a bit less away from like trades, but any knowledge-based kind of career or profession or marketing, if you're an entrepreneur and you're like, all right, you're telling me these things and I can see these things, but I have a rudimentary understanding of them, but I need to educate myself, where would you go?
Well, so there's a lot of good content on the web. So there's a lot of good books. You can start, of course, with my books and with your podcast. That's a good starting point.
Thank you for the plug there. That was great. NFTs for everyone and enter the metaverse.
I am completely self-taught in this topic. I have an education. I have a bachelor, master, and a PhD. But I'm completely self-taught. I have a bachelor in hospitality, and a master in marketing. I educated myself on these topics. And we need to embrace lifelong learning. We need to embrace that the world today will look fundamentally different 10 years from now. And 10 years from now, the world will look fundamentally different 5 years from now, and then 3 years from now. So the change is moving faster and faster and faster. So we have to be able to embrace this change and to educate ourselves to understand what's happening. And there are plenty of good sources out there. And I think I'm part of this online, which I recently joined, a book club called Bookflow, which is it sounds really nerdy, a book club. I never thought I would join a book club, but it's actually really interesting. And we cover books about emerging technologies, and we talk about them. We learn from the technologies, and it's like the modern version of a book club.
Oh, cool!
And it's really cool.
Is that like an online community?
Or? It's a growing online community that's been around for, I think, for a year and a half, and I only just recently joined.
What's it called, sir?
A Bookflow.
Bookflow.
And I love it. It's really interesting to be part of that, and we have great conversations. And there were like 30 people, 40 people from all around the world who join it.
Is that form part of this education where you're actually collaborating with other people and exploring ideas instead of kind of stabbing in the dark, formulating your own idea, and then that?
It's a combination of both. I read a lot. Like a lot. I read and listen to multiple books at the same time. Barely watch any TV. I think from that perspective, you need to educate yourself, and you need to go out and find the content. And yes, that's hard. That's hard work. But why are we otherwise here on Earth? You need to educate yourself.
So you mentioned your last book was written entirely by AI, obviously with your inputs. How else have you utilized AI to help you sort of get to where you are now as a digital speaker?
So I try to use AI wherever possible. So with my fourth book, Step Into the Metaverse, I also used AI in a very different format, because that book was completely written by myself. I did about 100 in-depth interviews, 150 surveys of people building the metaverse. And so it's very, very well, very in-depth researched on the metaverse. But I used tools to help me do that. So I had tools to automatically connect with the stakeholders. I had tools to automatically schedule the meetings. I had tools to transcribe the interviews. I had tools to summarize the interviews. Because otherwise I would not be able to write this book in 6 weeks.
6 weeks? Wow. You should write a book on how you wrote the book.
Yeah, probably. But that's where, for me, that was a fantastic example of using technology to augment yourself. It's kind of funny, because I signed a contract with my publisher in early November, and the objective was to have the book end of January. the draft manuscript ready. And so my first couple of weeks were focused on, 5-6 weeks, were focused on doing the interviews and you know, analyzing all of the information that's out there. So by come like mid-December, my publisher was really, really getting worried. You know, when are you going to deliver some content? I said, don't worry, it'll come. So on Boxing Day, I started to write. I wrote for 5 weeks straight, 7 days a week, 12 hours a day, and I had my book. Which was sort of a, I was sort of in a flow state myself for like 5 weeks, which was a really cool experience to do so. And you know, being in the state of mind of trying to achieve something. And I did the same thing with my PhD because I did my PhD in 2.5 years. Where you know you be in sort of flow of going you know, down a rabbit hole on a certain topic and really understanding what's happening. Actually, I'm speeding up myself because I did my fifth book. I did it in 5 days. So, but that was with AI, yeah. Obviously. So it's not completely fair, but it's also for me that really I went down the rabbit hole of ChatGPT in 5 days to really understand what's happening and to grasp and see that it's an advanced tool, but that's not the holy grail.
There's a bit of a skill in using. I mean, 5 days to write a book. Sure, someone could be like, "Oh, sure, I could do that," but it's actually not the case if you just go down that extra little step. There's an element of prompt engineering there that you have to teach yourself and how to understand how to ask the right prompt, ask the right question, and then formulate a response based on their feedback. So it's people that might be listening, it's like, oh, sure, like you're just using AI to write it. It's like, well, yeah, it's doing the manual work in terms of putting words that make sense with the correct syntax and vocab, sure. But to actually get there and get a response that's coherent, makes sense, factually correct, flows in with each other. That is the new skill set that is AI, I think, is starting to offer.
Absolutely.
As an entrepreneur is starting to look in and lean into this stuff, is this the kind of skill set and the stacks to really start to focus on and dive into if, say, they wanted to get into that flow state or that rabbit hole?
Absolutely. Generative AI is sort of democratizing creativity, you know, and it's the other day I saw Jamie Burke from Outlier Ventures. He posted that you know, the first job post of the prompt engineer, and guess how much the annual salary is of a prompt engineer with basic Python knowledge?
Tell me.
What do you think?
$200,000.
£300,000.
Get fucked.
Wow.
Yeah. Absolutely insane. So what are we doing here, guys?
I'm out, bro. You got this.
Sorry, I just would like to see Josh write one line of code. But yeah, all right. That's insane. So yeah. This is the 97 million jobs that are effectively coming onto the market. It's in this kind of realm.
Well, yeah, same thing. I use, you know, I'm delivering a keynote next week in Dubai, and I built my presentation with Midjourney and ChatGPT. And it's, you know, for Midjourney to get the right, I love Midjourney. Midjourney is amazing. But for you to get the right image out there is a lot of trial and error. Is understanding which, you know, parameters to use, which, you know, styles to use, you know, and that's trial and error, you know, and there's some good libraries out there that you can use nowadays. But that's, I think, you know, these technologies are awesome. And they, you know, as I said, I think therefore I create. That's really what it allows us to do. And now we still have to write, but, you know, give it another year or two and we will talk to it. And we can just literally have a conversation here while on the computer something is being built, whatever we say.
I'd love to just touch really quickly on your, was it 6-week flow state?
Yeah.
State?
Yeah.
Love to just hear about you, how you are managing your day, your time, and how you're such a high achiever and just crushing across the board.
Ah, good question. I think I just really like what I do.
It's a great place to start, really.
Yeah, yeah. I'm super passionate about what I do, you know, nobody is a child and say I want to become a futurist. I sort of rolled into that over the past decade, and I have embraced that now. So also with my research institute, you know, I've been playing around with a lot of different ideas, different business models for the past years. I've now found my sweet spot. I've found my mission, you know, why, what I want to do in my life. I consider myself very lucky in that regard. I'm very grateful that I have that. I'm just very passionate and I enjoy what I do. So for me, work is not work. It's just my life, you know, and I know that that's an exception. But I can only, you know, encourage everyone to try to find their passion, whatever it is, and because it makes life so much easier.
I was talking to someone about this yesterday. He's an engineer and now he's a chef, and I said, it's amazing that you've tried so many different things. And it seems, you know, from talking to you, whether you're cycling around Australia or doing a multitude of different startups, you've had experience with so many different spaces. Do you think that that has helped you to sort of hone in and find exactly what it is that you are passionate about? Because, you know, a lot of people give advice to find what you're passionate about, but more often than not, they don't actually explain how they got to it themselves.
Well, you can only find your passion by exploring, you know. If you sit back in your room on your chair, you will never find your passion because you don't know what you do. You need to go out and about and start exploring what it is that you are passionate about. And everyone is passionate about something. You just need to find it. And being more conscious and being more aware, you know, I'm reading a lot of books around that topic at the moment, which is opening my mind as well.
What do you think you could recommend?
In terms of a flow state, I was reading Stealing Fire, which is all about, you know, getting into a state of ecstasis, which is you know, really, really interesting book. I can definitely recommend that book. And it's having these books and understanding who you are. I'm currently reading Quiet, which is about the introvert versus extrovert, which is also very interesting because our society has been built. The Western society has been built for extroverts, while about 30-50% of the people is introvert, and they require a different approach to life. You know, and if you understand that you're introvert and you understand that, for example, loud music makes you anxious, which is a random example, then you can know that and you can do something about that. If you're able to find what your passion is, if you understand who you are, I think that what makes you tick, that is extremely useful.
You know, that has really come across this entire podcast. It's just been amazing just to hear you just go on and understand something and then be able to just dive straight into it. It's infectious. It's been been so awesome to brief and talk with you. Can't wait to see how you progress and engage with your digital identity online. Good luck in Dubai. I think that's an incredible opportunity. It's just so cool how you leaning into something has just created this incredible roadmap and this incredible ecosystem around you, and that you've been invited to speak about things that you're passionate on. I think that's a reflection of what anyone can do when you kind of explore and you lean into something, let alone what a cycle around Australia could do to you. So that's awesome.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it. And look forward to, we have to do this again. Like, there's just still so much on my page that I didn't even touch. So,
yeah. Well, thanks. I really appreciate it. Happy to have another conversation anytime. The world is your oyster. You know, if you find your passion, you can make it really, you can really enjoy it.